This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to another episode of Echoes of Dissent, a weekly podcast that explores the events, the movements, the beliefs and the personalities. In short, the why a song of protest, a song of dissent was written and sung, and who created it. We look at its impact at the time and its relevance to today. My name is Frank Carter, and today we dive into a song that was at the forefront of the worldwide environmental movement some 50, close to 50 years ago. On researching for this program, it became clear that the story has a number of twists. Originally, I thought this song was the main driver of the success in this particular protest. But however, as we research, we find that the song actually came towards the end of that protest, but it still remains a reminder to us of a successful protest, a successful protest model. The story has a number of twists, from radio commercial to a bit of legislative skullduggery and a campaign that swung an election. And as I said, it leads us to a very good model on which to build any successful protest. So back to 1972, when the government had said, "We will not raise the Manapouri Lake," but this was the new government. The new Labour government had just been elected, and they had been elected on the platform Save Manapouri. So one of the most important songs in New Zealand music history is still, in 1972, a radio commercial for Pink Bats.
Of a waterfall which dazzles with its spray. Tall and strong and aged, contented and serene, a kauri tree surveys this grand domain. And from miles and miles around him, the sea rolling green, tomorrow all this beauty won't remain. Damn the dam, cried the fantail, as he flew in. Rainfall from above and splashes on the ground, goes running down a mountain to the sea, and leaping over pebbles makes such a joyful sound, such is Mother Nature's gift to me. I have grave reflection, reflection of a grave, trees that once lived green now dim brown.
This surely must be one of the most iconic New Zealand tracks. To understand Damn the Dam fully, we do need to go back to the world in which it was born, which is 1972. At the time, John Hanlon had been asked to write a a radio commercial. And he was commissioned to write a radio commercial for Pink Betts, because the company that made Pink Betts was trying to encourage the government to insulate its homes, you know, the state houses, and also trying to persuade the rest of the population to insulate their homes as well. It was a radio commercial, 1972. But going back before that, in January 1960, the government had signed a deal with the Consolidated Zinc Company to basically grant exclusive use of the water. Now, get this, exclusive use of the water from Lake Manapouri and Teano Lake for power generating for 99 years. And this agreement allowed Kamalcom to raise Lake Manapouri by 100 feet. That's 30 meters, drowning the ancient beaches and the pristine nature of the forest and the shoreline. By 1971, this had become possible through legislation. There had, of course, been long concerns about the impact on the environment. And during those years in the late 60s and early 70s, the Save Manapouri campaign gathered pace. But it was still almost batting against a brick wall, because in 1971, the government of the day said, okay, yeah, we'll pass legislation which says that we don't need to build a dam at the moment, or we don't need to raise the lake of Manapouri, but we just put this little clause in which says that, you know, in case we need to, we will be allowed to. Well, of course, that set the campaign on fire. So in 1971, the Save the Manapouri campaign enters its final battle, its battle against this legislation. And we see a perfect model for a successful protest. The Save Manapouri campaign is often seen as one of the New Zealand's most effective environmental movements, not because it was loud or radical, but because it was strategic, disciplined, and widely supported, successful campaign. So the issue, basically, what was the issue? The issue was the government wanted to raise the lake and flood large areas of pristine forest in Fiordland National Park, one of the most ecologically unique places in the world. It remained untouched. And so why was this successful? Okay, so, you know, we've got this issue. We want to save the lake. What do we do? What do we do? The campaign built mass public support. It wasn't a niche activist movement. It became a national cause. Around 10% of New Zealand's population signed a petition. Now, in those days, there was less than 3 million, about 2.6 million people. Over 260,000 people signed a petition. And in those days, you know, it wasn't just click on your keyboard or your mouse and there's my signature or there I agree with that petition. They had to have bits of paper and people had to sign it and put their names and addresses. This is way before the internet. And the issue was framed, protect a natural treasure versus industrial damage. So there's the contrast. That was the how it was framed. We need to protect this beauty. Otherwise, we've got lots of industrial damage. Farmers, students, scientists, urban residents, the unions. The unions got behind it. In fact, the Waterfront Union actually did a bit of a protest and they stopped handling stuff for export in protest against the possibility of raising this lake. So a whole range of organisations, National Bird and Forest, of course. So the campaign made the environment protection feel like a shared national responsibility. It's a national thing. It's not just a partisan, it's just a small group of people. This is a national responsibility to save this lake. And they avoided the extreme tactics. They didn't sort of jump up and down or climb buildings or knock things over or storm parliament or anything. They used peaceful advocacy, petitions, public meetings, media engagement. Scientists and experts were heavily involved, giving the campaign authority. Now, of course, these days we get all sorts of experts coming up and putting their hands up. And to be honest, we do get a little bit blasé about all these experts with these PhDs and whatever, whatever. But back then, scientists probably seemed to have a little bit more, better reputation. I don't know, authority. But anyway, they got scientists and experts were heavily involved. David Bellamy, a world-renowned environmentalist, came in to help lead it. David Bellamy and Norman Kirk, who became Prime Minister. There was the two people leading it. And the leaders presented themselves as reasonable. We are reasonable people. We're not anti-development. We're just pro-smart decision-making. And this was a key as well, because they were not against the smelter. They just didn't want the smelter to create ruin the lake. There was suggestions, there was a lot of thought put into what are the alternatives? How can we meet both demands or both requirements? And so that's the campaign actually contributed to a win-win situation. So this was another aspect. So because the campaigners were so reasonable, because it was a national felt as a national responsibility, it was very hard for the opponents to dismiss these people as, you know, floppy-haired radicals or anarchists or whatever. That was a key. And they had strong leadership. As I mentioned, Norman Kirk, who later became Prime Minister, David Bellamy helped with international awareness. And then they got into politics, of course. Instead of staying outside the system, the campaign actually engaged directly with it. And the issue became central to the 1972 general election, where Norman Kirk and the Labour Party pledged to keep the lake levels natural. They weren't going to raise them. And when Labour won, they followed through. And this was the key to the campaign. The campaign converted public pressure into electoral consequences. And there was quite a bit of comment afterwards by, you know, ex-national MPs that, yeah, this is what lost them the election. The fact that in 71, they said, we're not going to build a dam, not going to lift the lake, but we're going to leave a little clause in there that will let us do it later. So there was a clear, achievable goal, nationwide net grassroots network. And there was local committees formed across the country. Volunteers collected petition signatures in towns and cities. So the protest movement became embedded in the community. And the outcome, of course, led to a world-first solution. They built a major power station, but they built it underground. And they left the lake in its natural state. And also the incoming Labour government formed a guardians framework, sort of the guardians of Manapouri, with the mandate, if you like, to make sure that the lake was cared for, looked after, and nobody was going to sort of walk all over it and come in and try and build dams. And it's still going today, you know, in the 2020s. And the guardians of Lake Manapouri framework is still there. And it works along with the people, the Comalco or whoever owns the aluminium smelter now, works along with them and the government to ensure that the lake is maintained and retained. So to summarise, by 1970, 264,000, I've got the exact number, 907, look at that, 264,907 New Zealanders, almost 10% of the population, had signed the Manapouri petition before the internet, before social media. The incoming Labour government scuttled the dam proposal. They said, nope, this will not happen. We will get rid of that clause which says, oh, maybe if we need it, or if we think need it, gone. The song, Damn the Dam, didn't arrive until 1973 into the public consciousness. In 1972, it was commissioned to be a Pink Bats radio commercial, but it was taken on board by the Save Manapouri campaign and released in 1973. Interestingly, after the immediate crisis had passed, and to be honest, I had always thought that this song was instrumental in saving the dam. In actual fact, it's not. It's the one we go to when we think of the dam. But the song remains with us, and it captured something beyond politics. It captured grief and beauty, the grief of losing and the beauty and the love of the land. Let's hear what that sounds like, verse by verse, how John Hannon wove the strands of the environment into a continuing anthem for the environmental movement, which is still there today. And before we go any further, this was the beginning of the Greens movement, 1972, England, Australia, New Zealand, the first Green movement parties. The Values Party came out of this movement.
Be forced to kiss the image of a mountain. The early morning mist has ceased to play. Birds dancing lightly on the branches by a fountain of a waterfall which dazzles.
Right from the first line, John Hannon does something quite extraordinary. He doesn't open with anger. He doesn't open with politics. He opens with tenderness. Leaf falls to kiss the image of a mountain. A leaf doesn't just fall. It kisses its own reflection. And you can see in the still water, it's a scene of perfect, undisturbed peace. The early morning mist ceased to play. Again, there's that personification. The mist has been playing. The birds are dancing. This landscape is alive, joyful, almost childlike in its innocence, it's introduced us. And then a waterfall, which dazzles with its spray. The word dazzles is doing a lot of work here. It tells us that this water has energy, brilliance, light. It's spectacular, and it is free. One of the things Hanlon is doing in this opening verse is building a case, not through argument, but through image. He's making you fall in love with this place before he tells you what's going to happen to it. The music under this is gentle, open, major key. The guitar picking is unhurried. You're being eased in. The melody has that classic early New Zealand 70s folk feel.
Tall and strong and aged, contented and serene, a kauri tree surveys this grand domain. And from miles and miles around him, the sea rolling green. Tomorrow all this beauty won't remain.
Hanlon introduces the kauri as a character. Tall and strong and aged, contented and serene. He's invoking something deeply woven into New Zealand identity. The kauri isn't just a tree, it's an elder. It surveys its domain. It's been watching over this valley since before humans arrived. And then, the hammer blow, tomorrow all this beauty won't remain. That word tomorrow is devastating in context. This isn't abstract. This isn't distant. He has built that beautiful picture. He's opened up. We can see it in our minds. But tomorrow, the kauri's world will be underwater. He's shifting from plural to singular here. The song has given us birds, mist, waterfalls, the plural abundance of nature. But the kauri is singular. He surveys the land. There's something deeply lonely about it. And the loneliness foreshadows what's coming. Isolation, then drowning. This is where the song starts to ache.
Damn the dam, cried the fantail, as he flew into the sky. To give part to the people, all this beauty has to die. Rainfall from above and splashes on the ground.
The chorus arrives like a cry from the wilderness, and this actually is the line that we all remember. Damn the dam, cried the fantail. Pee waka waka, the fantail. Again, from those outside New Zealand, the pee waka waka or fantail is one of the most beloved and familiar birds in Aotearoa. Small, flitty, intensely curious, often following you through the bush as if keeping you company. Hanlon chose this brilliantly. The fantail is not an eagle. It's not a symbol of strength or power. It's tiny, it's vulnerable. It is the most ill-equipped creature imaginable to stand against the government dam project. And yet it cries out, damn the dam. As he flew into the sky, that repetition is interesting. It has slightly stumbling quality, as if the words can barely keep up with the feeling. The bird is flying upward, away, escaping something that cannot be escaped. Then the bitter irony, to give power to the people. We'll come to that in a moment. All this beauty has to die. Now, there is two meanings there. They give power to the people. The proposal was, of course, that the lake be raised, so get more power, more electricity for the people, for New Zealanders. But there's power to the people is often a rallying cry of protest. So there's an interesting double play here. But so power to the people, power for New Zealand, power, this electricity power, of course. But in whose names and at what cost? The line doesn't mess around. It states, it's almost resigned, all this beauty has to die. And that's the cost of the power. Not might die, but could die, has to.
Rainfall from above and splashes on the ground, goes running down a mountain to the sea, and leaping over pebbles makes such a joyful sound, such is Mother Nature's gift to me.
This is perhaps the simplest verse in the song, but perhaps the most moving. After the grief of verse 2 and the fury of the chorus, Hanlon pulls back. He reminds us of what water actually is in its natural state. It falls, it splashes, it runs, it leaps. That work again, like the birds dancing in verse 1. The water has joy, it has purpose, it's going somewhere. down the mountain to the sea, following the path it has always followed. Such is Mother Nature's gift to me. The shift to the first person is significant. Throughout the first two verses, the song has described the landscape almost objectively, the leaf, the mist, the coyote, but now it becomes personal to me. This is Hanlon inserting himself, and by extension, all of us, into the landscape. This is not just a beautiful place. It is a gift. It belongs to us, all of us, not to a power company, not to an aluminium smelter, to me and all of us. It's a quiet, understated claim of ownership, and it's far more powerful than any angry slogan.
I have grave reflection of a grave. Trees that once lived green, now dead and brown. The homes of tiny animals and little birds as well. For the sake of man's progression, have been drowned.
This is the darkest verse, and it's the most striking. I have grave reflection of a grave. That wordplay, grave as serious and grave as burial. He uses the double meaning again. It's remarkable for a pop song. The narrator, John Hanlon, looks into the water and sees not a beautiful reflection, but a cemetery. The image of a flooded valley appears here, not as a prediction, but as a memory. This verse is written as if John Hanlon has already seen what the dam would do, perhaps because by 1973, versions of it had already happened elsewhere in New Zealand and around the world. Lake Monowai, not far from Manapouri, had been raised decades earlier to catastrophic environmental effect. Trees that once lived green, now dead and brown. Flooded trees are among the most haunting images in the landscape of dam-affected country. Bleached trees standing like ghosts in still water. It's an image that has defined the aftermath of dam-building projects worldwide. The homes of tiny animals and little birds as well. For the sake of man's progression have been drowned. Note the word progression is not development, not need, progression. There's a biting sarcasm here. This is the language of the 1960s. Growth, consensus, progress, development and modernization turn back on itself. Is it really progress to drown the homes of tiny animals? Is this what we mean by moving forward? The word drowned is heavy. It applies to animals, birds and implicitly to the landscape, and it will be echoed in every future flooded valley people will picture as the chorus returns. No call to arms, just the echo. All this beauty has to die hanging in the air. The song has retrospectively become associated with the Save Manapouri campaign. Since the release, it followed on from successful conclusion of the campaign. It is now popularly recognised as an anthem in tribute to one of New Zealand's longest and hardest fought environmental campaigns. It's also an anthem for the future, for anything that comes after that. Any environmental project, it is in our national memory, if you like, consciousness. So what do we make of Dam the Dam? In 2024, much of The Guardian's work today, and this is The Guardian's framework that was set up by the Kirk government, the Labour government in 1973, to save the dam in perpetuity. Work involves ensuring Meridian Energy, which operates the power station, maintains the lake within its natural levels while generating power. But the questions the song raises haven't gone away. They've got bigger. Every new generation inherits the same tension: economic development versus environmental preservation. Power for the people versus beauty for the people. Progress versus the places that make us who we are. What John Lennon and the Save Manapouri campaign understood, perhaps instinctively, is that you don't win people over to an environment cause by lecturing them. You win them by making them feel what they stand to lose, by making them fall in love first, then and only then you tell them that it's in danger, and you offer a win-win. A leaf falls to kiss the image of a mountain, and a tiny bird flies. The Manapouri protest succeeded and gives us a model for a successful campaign. Briefly, a broad, unlikely coalition. It brought together unions, forest and bird, students, mums and dads, communities, conservationists. This showed that environment wasn't just for greenies, which was a new concept at the time. This is the beginning, really, of the worldwide environmental consciousness. It was a mainstream Kiwi value. It had a simple message. Damn the dam. Political leverage at the right moment. There was an election coming up, 1972. Norman Kirk had been involved in the campaign, clearly, and he was a leader of the Labour Party, and they promised to save the lake. And the voters and this song held him to it. And there was a lasting institutional solution. The creation of the Guardians of Lake Manapouri and Te Anau was brilliant. It took the issue out of day-to-day politics. It's taken it away from political this or that, this party or that party, or arguments. It's taken it away from politics and give an independent expert's ongoing authority to protect the lake. Environmentalists today often cite this as a model for other campaigns. And perhaps most important, the campaign posed a solution that saved the lake but did not stop progress. It forced it to be smarter. People actually thought, we don't want this to happen, so we need to think. We need to offer a solution. We need to help to be part of the solution. It proved that a nation could generate massive industrial power without necessarily sacrificing its most treasured natural landscape by thinking. Thank you very much for listening. This podcast is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Next week, our neighborhood anarchist, David Robex, with his 2002 version that asks, who would Jesus bomb? Thanks for listening.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.